Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. My name is Stephen Sewer. I'm program chair for the Now and Then Speaker Series, and I'll be your moderator for tonight's program. In this year-long series, which was conceived by Dr. Carol Fleming, the Commonwealth Club of California will examine the evolution of American life and culture since World War II from a variety of perspectives. We're inviting recognized leaders to share their knowledge and observations about this important period from their particular area of expertise. In addition, we would like speakers to extrapolate about the trajectory of their field. What can we expect in the next 10 years? With the baby boom generation fast approaching retirement, this seems an appropriate time to pause and consider what these changes have meant to the people who have lived through this period of history and to American culture more broadly. Tonight, the Commonwealth Club of California is delighted and honored to present our next Now and Then speaker, Richard Kovacevic, Chairman of Wells Fargo & Company. As a young man, one of the first business principles Dick Kovacevic learned as the manager of a produce department was the eloquent phrase, sell it or smell it. It was in that first career in a supportive Washington community where Dick formulated his work ethic and his focus on the customer, which served him well later as he would go on to write the roadmap for one of America's great companies. Dick grew up with a love of sports and turned down an offer to sign with the New York Yankees and chose instead to pitch at Stanford, where he earned his bachelor's and master's degrees in industrial engineering. He continued as a Cardinal and received his MBA from the Stanford Graduate School of Business, where he graduated at the top of his class. In 1986, Dick joined Wells Fargo's predecessor company, Norwest Corporation, as vice chairman and head of the banking group. He was named president and COO in 1989, and he won the chairmanship in 1995. At the time he joined, Norwest was a Midwestern regional bank that had struggled with performance. Dick slashed expenses and drastically curtailed the bank's agricultural and international loan portfolios. Norwest entered the 90s fully recovered and emerged as one of the nation's most profitable regional banks. The strengthened balance sheet allowed Norwest to purchase many other banks in key markets, culminating in the 1998 merger with Wells Fargo & Company. Dick was named chief executive officer and president, and in 2001, he was appointed chairman of the board. Today, Dick holds responsibility for some 165,000 Wells Fargo team members. With the announced purchase of Wachovia, Dick has led Wells Fargo to become the largest and most highly rated bank in the United States. Dick is the architect of Wells Fargo's innovative cross-sell strategy built upon relationship banking. Simply put, his focus is to build relationships with customers that lead them to more financially successful lives, uncovering additional opportunities for products and services along the way. Wells Fargo has one of the best cross-sell ratios in the industry, evidence of Dick's relentless drive to reach the Great Eight, the bank's initiative to achieve 8 product sales to each customer. Dick sits on the boards of directors of Cargill, Cisco Systems, and Target Corporation, and he was appointed by Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger to the California Commission for Jobs and Economic Growth. As chief executive, he received lifetime achievement honors from the San Francisco Business Times, and this past Tuesday, he was inducted into the Bay Area Council's Hall of Fame. Dick is a leading philanthropist. His support for the nonprofit community has led Wells Fargo to become one of the Bay Area's and one of America's most generous corporations. He serves on the Board of Governors of the San Francisco Symphony, and he is a trustee of the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art. Dick lives with his wife, Mary Jo, in San Francisco, a woman I've heard referred to more than once now as the boss. Please welcome back to our rostrum America's banker, Dick Kovacevic.
Thank you very much, Stephen, for those gracious remarks. The boss is here, so I will behave myself this evening. Good evening, everyone. It's a pleasure for me to be back here again. In fact, the last time I was here was November 16th, 1999. And that was a year after the merger of Norwest and Wells Fargo. And I told you then how excited I was about our merger, that this is a merger that was going to take the best from both companies, the best people, the best business models, the best technology, such that the new Wells Fargo would be much, much better than either company had been before. As confident as I was of that prediction, our success over the past 10 years has exceeded even my wildest hopes and dreams, thanks to the talent and leadership, commitment, the focus and hard work of my 169,000 colleagues. It is now considered the most successful large merger in banking history and among the best in any industry. And I want to thank all of you, especially those who I see in the audience who are customers of Wells Fargo, for your strong support and warm welcome to our new company and to Mary Jo and myself personally. Mary Jo and I consider San Francisco our home now, and we expect to continue living here in the Bay Area for the foreseeable future. Since I was asked to make this speech almost 4 months ago, how did you know what I was going to say? The financial world has changed dramatically and of epic proportions. We are today in the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. However, being true to the request from the Commonwealth Club, I will not address the current events directly. To do so would require all the time we have this evening. And I would be pleased, however, to address the crisis or any other subject you wished in the question and answer session. So, keeping with the original script, I have been asked to provide you a retrospective post-World War II through today and tomorrow of the banking and financial services industry here in the United States. For the first 25 years of that period, up until 1975, I could describe it in one word: boring. In fact, when I graduated from Stanford Business School in 1967, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I did know, however, what I didn't want to do, and I didn't want to work for a bank. Back then, it was sleepy, unimaginative, a clubby business. We call it the 363 industry. Bankers paid 3% for deposits, charged 6% for loans, and were on the golf course by 3 p.m. At a retirement party for the CEO of a major bank in the 1960s, he was asked, "During your 45-year career, what was the greatest innovation in banking?" And he thought for a moment and replied, "Air conditioning." I'm not making this up. This is true. Let me give you some statistics to make my point. Wells Fargo started as a business in 1852, and Norwest, where I worked before merging with Wells Fargo, started in 1873. By 1950, almost 100 years later, our combined assets were less than $3 billion. Not very exciting. By 1985, they were still, again, both companies together, were still only about $50 billion, 13 times larger than 1950, but still not that much growth. Today, they are $610 billion, over 200 times larger than 1950. And when our recently announced merger with Wachovia is completed by year-end, we will be nearly $1.5 trillion. Now, that's very exciting. So what was it that happened between 1985 and 2008 that caused this unprecedented growth? Well, four very powerful forces emerged all about the same time: deregulation, new technologies, non-bank competition, and industry consolidation. But let's begin at the beginning. Since the early days, banks have provided three basic services. First, safe and secure storage of cash and valuables. Think of the Wells Fargo agents in the 1850s safely storing the miner's gold and giving him a certificate of deposit. The CD name is still in use today, but instead of gold, it's your money that you deposit. Second, we provided loans. And third, we facilitate purchase and payments. And nothing much has changed radically since that beginning in the 1100s. In the United States, up through the 1960s, everyone went to their bank to do banking. There was no direct deposit of paychecks. You went to the bank to deposit your check. There were no ATMs. You went to the bank to get cash. If you were lucky and your local supermarket knew you, you might get extra cash beyond your grocery purchases when you paid by check. And they better know and trust you, because otherwise they wouldn't accept checks, only cash. There were no credit or debit cards. There was no internet. No telephone banking except during banking hours, and you better get there before 3 p.m. because banks closed at that time. There was no weekend banking. In fact, banks closed at 3 p.m. because they had a lot of after-hour clerical work to do to balance the books, and I mean balance it literally by hand, with handwritten entries to the debits or credits in the general ledger. And then after that, they would send their checks to the Federal Reserve to be exchanged with other banks. The banks' premises themselves were massively large, with high ceilings, marble edifices to convey safety and security. Pillars were part of many banks' architecture, representing pillars of strength. In fact, just go down to the old Crocker Headquarters Bank here just around the corner. And that was a close example of what the headquarter banks were around the country. Inside the bank, there were lines of tellers, clerks processing paper, a beehive of activity, men in suits at desks doing what they consider the important business, the bank president in his corner office. Women were only tellers, clerks, and secretaries. In fact, it was only during World War II, when men went off to war, that women even worked at banks at all. Prior to the war, most of all the tellers, clerks, and messengers were men. Many bank presidents started right out of high school as tellers or messengers and rose up to the ranks to become president. In fact, it wasn't until the 1960s that women entered the officer ranks in banking, and even then, very slowly. It took until the 1990s for women to reach the senior executive ranks. Even today, Wells Fargo is one of the few banks who has a woman, Carrie Tolstead, running our largest group, Community Banking. And she is one of a few women who is among the top five highest paid officers of a major bank. Back then, practically each office was a business in itself that often housed the bank's president, several executive vice presidents, senior vice presidents, and so on. Each bank branch processed and stored their own customers' checks. They balanced the books every night. They stuffed checks and statements in envelopes and mailed them directly to their customers. Major corporations physically close to the bank deposited all of their checks and did all their business at that bank office. There was practically no technology other than adding machines and later calculators. When you made a deposit to your savings, you brought along your little savings book, and the teller actually wrote in her handwriting the date and the amount of the deposit, added it to your previous balance, updated any interest you earned since the last deposit, again using the adding machine. A similar process ensued when you made a loan payment. Loans, by the way, were often made based on character and how well you were known in the community, not by balance sheets and income statements. It was pretty basic and archaic by today's standards. Technology changed all that and dramatically altered bank premises. When the first computers in the mid-1950s and 60s using punch cards began to process the paper rather than checks, all things changed. And starting in the 1970s, the clerical functions were taken out of the bank branches and centralized in operating centers with computers processing the paperwork for all the branches of that bank. Computer terminals now calculated interest and printed the receipt, not tellers. But it took almost till the 1990s for this process to be completed by all the banks around the country. To put this in perspective, prior to 1990, large bank branches would have 200 or more people working in the branch, with only about 25% of those people interacting directly with customers. Today, that same bank would have about 30 people, an 85% reduction, with 100% of them interacting with customers. In the United States, up until the 1980s, banks were highly regulated with severe restrictions on what products could be offered. Regulators determined the maximum rates that could be paid on deposits, known as Regulation Q, and state usury laws dictated the maximum amount you could charge for loans. Since banks were not allowed to pay a market rate of interest, they gave premiums, so-called toasters, I'm sure many of you remember those, to open or increase deposits. The premium offered varied from scarves and ties to coffee makers, Cuisinars, to hunting rifles in Texas. But even the value of the premiums were regulated. Banks were restricted to branches in only their home state, and only a very few states even had statewide branching. This made all banks geographically concentrated. Very stupid. In short, banking was boring because the government told you what products you could offer, what prices you could charge, and where you could do business. There was no room for creativity, innovation, or nationwide competition, for that matter. This regulatory stranglehold reflected who worked for banks. If you were a white, male, Protestant, graduate of an Ivy League school, and a low-handicap golfer, you qualified as a banker. Others need not apply. Promotions were based more on who you knew, not what you knew, and your length of service. It was a club where titles such as cashiers, assistant vice president, vice president, senior vice presidents, and executive vice presidents were a substitute for pay. Everyone had a title. That was not the kind of environment that appealed to me when I received my MBA, and so instead I went to work for General Mills, a world-class consumer marketing company. Unable to branch beyond their home state, larger banks during the 1950s and 60s expanded internationally. Led by Walt Wriston of Citibank and David Rockefeller of Chase, New York money center banks follow their commercial customers overseas and open branches all over the world. Think about that for a moment. A New York bank could open a bank in Hong Kong or London, but not in New Jersey or Connecticut. Banks had a serious problem of how to find deposits to fund their loans, given Reg Q deposit rate restrictions and competition from money market funds, who could pay market rates and were not subject to Regulation Q. Led by CEO Walt Wriston, Citibank began a full-court press to find loopholes in the laws to get around these restrictions until the laws themselves could be changed. In the 1950s, in order to get around a deposit rate restriction, Citibank, with others, invented what is called the Eurodollar. A Eurodollar is simply a book entry, not real dollars in an actual account, of a dollar-based deposit outside the United States that is backed 100% by an actual dollar on deposit in the United States. Because it is theoretically outside the United States, banks could pay a market rate for the deposit, getting around the U.S. restrictions on deposit and loan pricing. In fact, Wells Fargo still uses this Eurodollar loophole to pay interest on commercial checking accounts until we are able to do so directly in 2011, 60 years later. But even Eurodollars couldn't supply all the deposits needed by corporations to fund their expansion. So a little later, the negotiable certificate of deposit was invented by Citibank. This was a bearer instrument, not in the name of any particular holder, and thus not technically a deposit, but merely a piece of paper saying there was, say, $1 million on deposit at a bank at the bank, paying such and such interest rate, maturing at such and such time, and could be redeemed on that date. They were issued to corporations and foreign banks and could be traded in the securities market without restrictions as to the interest rate, which changed according to the market. In 1968, Citibank established what was then the first bank holding company. This corporate structure had a bank as a subsidiary, but also could include under the holding company other financial services that were prohibited to be owned by a bank, like, say, a nationwide mortgage company, a leasing company, finance company, and venture capital company. This was a loophole to get around product restrictions and the McFadden Act that restricted interstate banking. Now, I could go on and on, but I think you get the picture. All of these were simply creative innovations to get around restrictive laws and regulations. Walt Wriston's vision, however, was that you could never supply the capital needs of corporate America unless you could freely tap the main source of deposits in the country, which was the consumer. So in 1974, he put John Reed, a rising young star at Citibank, in charge of developing a worldwide consumer banking business for Citicorp. The consumer bank under John Reed was charged with two goals. First, develop a worldwide large and profitable consumer services business. And second, change the laws and or find loopholes that will allow banks to offer products that consumers wanted at prices that reflected market rates and to do business anywhere and any place banks wanted to be. John, who succeeded Walt Wriston as CEO of Citicorp in 1985, quickly decided that he did not have the talent within Citicorp to accomplish these goals, so he began to recruit a number of people with consumer marketing backgrounds from companies like, you guessed it, General Mills, where I worked, General Foods, and Procter & Gamble.
I was recruited by John in 1974. Over the next 20 years, the industry completely changed and became one of the most exciting, fastest-growing, most profitable industries in corporate America. I will share some of my personal experience with you of what happened and why it happened. About this same time, the middle 70s, non-bank competitors became very aggressive and innovative in competing with banks. Money market funds were born. They now have assets of over $3.5 trillion, more than what all banks have in their checking accounts. By the end of 2007, money funds held 31% of all corporate America's short-term assets. Mutual funds also became popular as an investment, offering higher returns, and now have assets of about $11 trillion, 50% more than the total deposits of all banks. Unlike banks, there was no rate restrictions on these products, but banks were prohibited from even offering them. Technology was also becoming increasingly important to the banking industry, not only automating the back office, but used by consumers for self-service. The first ATMs that are ubiquitous today had only been recently installed. After a couple of years of running Citibank's domestic division, in 1976, I was put in charge of the New York banking division. This was Citicorp's largest and most important consumer business. The division had 300 branches throughout New York, had a 3% market share, and was losing $100 million a year. We obviously had a problem and needed to make lots of changes. Citibank was already well along in the development of its own proprietary ATM machine, which was much more convenient, secure, and consumer-friendly than the ATMs that were on the market at that time. Early in 1977, my division launched the 24-hour-a-day Citibank Banking Center. We put two ATMs in every branch inside the vestibule of the branch and at the entrance, so it was out of the winter weather, and it was accessed by your Citicard ATM card. It cost us $250 million. It was a vast sum of money even today. It was actually a huge risk, as no other bank in the industry had done anything remotely similar to this scale. It was by far the largest network of ATMs in the United States. With our advertising agency, we created the now famous tagline, "The City Never Sleeps," a tagline, by the way, that Citibank just revived about 6 months ago for their current advertising some 30 years later. Over the next few years, because of these Citibank bank setters and by doing a lot of other things related to deregulation and other initiatives, which I'll explain in a minute, our market share soared from 3% to 11%, and we became very highly profitable. Very few banks, if any, have ever moved 8 share points in 4 years. By 1980, we had become very profitable, and Walt Wriston's and John Reed's bet on the consumer business was already beginning to pay off. Now, not everyone loved our banking centers. I remember visiting one of our branches during the introduction, and an elderly gentleman was watching with amazement as the machine was spitting out $10 bills to a customer. And I asked the man, I said, would you like to learn how to use the machine? Because you could use the machine to get cash even at midnight. He quickly replied, "Nope." "Well, why?" I asked. The elder gentleman looked at me and said, "Listen, sonny, anything I need money for that late at night, I shouldn't be doing." Doesn't that sound like a New Yorker? I worked for John Reed during my 11 years at Citibank and ran at one time or another all their consumer businesses domestically and internationally. But because I was in charge of Citibank's New York banks from 1977 through 1982, I was also very involved, along with Walt Wriston and Citibank's legal and government relations team, in attempting to get those laws changed relative to product expansion, elimination of interest rate restrictions, and allowing interstate banking, because they directly impacted my business. Walt Wriston was hands down the person most responsible for starting the process that changed the state-old world of banking to the dynamic, high-growth financial services industry that we know today. He was a mentor to me, and I was his tennis partner for 10 years at corporate functions. And change we did. What really got things started and became the poster child for deregulation was an innovative product called the Cash Management Account that was created by Merrill Lynch in 1971 under the direction of CEO Don Regan, who later, by the way, became the Secretary of the Treasury and Chief of Staff in President Reagan's administration and led the charge for financial deregulation. The CMA was a money market fund that paid market rates of interest, but also had innovative features such as check writing privileges and a debit card. Because it was not technically a deposit, it could be sold at Merrill Lynch offices throughout the entire United States, pay a market rate of interest, not only for savings needs, but also for checking account balances, since consumers could write checks on it or use a debit card to pay bills or buy things. It therefore got around all the regulations of both interstate banking and deposit rates. Walt Wriston admired the innovation, but was furious that banks were not allowed to have a similar product. The need became even greater when interest rates in the early 1980s climbed to over 20%, and banks were still restricted to paying a 5% maximum rate. With the CMA, banks no longer had a monopoly on deposits and were losing deposits to Merrill Lynch and other money market fund companies by the hundreds of billions. Citibank took out ads saying this was unfair to the small saver and urged voters to write their congressman. The 1980s was a very difficult time for our economy, as many of you, I'm sure, remember. We had the Arab oil embargo, 16% inflation, 20% interest rates, double-digit unemployment, and a severe recession resulting from Chairman of the Federal Reserve Paul Volcker's tight money policy. All of this led to the collapse of the commercial real estate market in the United States. Savings banks across the country were going bankrupt, as well as commercial banks in certain hard-hit states like Texas. The Continental Illinois Bank in Chicago failed, the largest bank failure at that time in the U.S. banking history, as well as the Seafirst Bank in the state of Washington. Money center banks were hit by restructuring costs for less developed country debt, especially countries in Latin America. But this economic debacle provided us with a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. We all went on the attack, and especially me, as I was in charge of our banks in New York, and thus my business was impacted. It was an ideal time to kill Regulation Q, the interest rate ceiling regulation, once and for all. I was in Washington, D.C. often, talking especially with Bill Isaac, who was the head of the FDIC. All these names, by the way, if you've been reading the paper, are still talking about some of the issues today. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation about the need to raise deposit rates above 5% so banks could be competitive and keep the economy going. I saw Paul Volcker, chairman of the Federal Reserve, at a bank industry reception and explained how important it was to free rates. A few weeks later, he told a top Citicorp officer, "Who was that tall guy with the long last name who backed me into the shrimp bowl talking about abolishing Reg Q?" I usually get noticed at these things, as some people know. So by the spring of 1980, President Carter signed the Depository Institution Deregulation and Monetary Decentralization Act, which called for a six-year phase-out of Regulation Q. Some call this the most important banking bill since the Glass-Steagall Act of 1933. Later, we received permission to offer so-called NOW accounts that were invented by and approved by credit union regulators. In essence, it was in an interest-bearing checking account. So now that the deposit side of the ledger was being deregulated, we still had restrictive state usury laws for loans. We went to work on that. In the 1980s, the usury laws in the state of New York put the maximum rate that you could charge for a credit card at 12%. Now, in a 20% interest rate environment, that obviously didn't work. You don't make that up on the volume, as they say. We tried to get New York State to change their usury laws so credit cards would be profitable. They refused. So some colleagues of mine at Citicorp worked with the governor of South Dakota and committed 2,500 new jobs in South Dakota if the state passed a favorable credit card legislation. The state did, and Citibank set up its credit card shop in South Dakota that now employs 7,500 people. Other banks followed Citibank to South Dakota, and it is now the largest industry in South Dakota outside of agriculture. In the early 1980s, the limit on mortgage rates in New York was 6%. Since we were paying almost that much for deposits, it obviously wasn't profitable. So I worked with some New York legislators and committed $1 billion in new mortgage financing if New York raised the ceiling. This commitment made the front page of the New York Times the next day. The only problem was that my boss, John Reed, forgot to tell Walt Wriston and the other senior executives what we had committed to. So they asked, who allowed Dick to commit $1 billion of Citibank money to low-rate mortgages? Well, after a rather interesting meeting in Walt's office, everyone did agree that we made the right decision. The mortgage rate was lifted shortly thereafter to 8.5% and eventually eliminated altogether. Now, all of these efforts caused almost all states to fall in line and revise their own usury laws so that market-based rates would prevail. If not, the business would be moved to another state, where the consumers in those states would unlikely receive loans. Despite these successes, we still had two dragons to slay: restrictions on interstate banking and the elimination of the Glass-Steagall Act, which kept banks out of investment banking and the insurance business. By 1986, I had left Citibank and joined Norwest Corporation in Minneapolis, but my zeal for deregulation went with me. I continued even more vigorously to promote full interstate banking because Norwest was locked into the slower-growing Midwest, and we wanted to expand to the faster-growing states here in the West. During 1960 and 1970s, at the urging of banks, state laws began to slowly change, allowing banks to branch to adjoining counties within their own state and eventually to the entire state. But banks still couldn't cross state lines. By the late 1980s, states that bordered each other, often states where people worked in one state but commuted from another state, got together, urged by banks, to form regions where all banks in the region could branch in each other's states. Finally, after decades of intense lobbying by the entire banking industry, Congress in 1994 repealed the McFadden Act, allowing full interstate banking. This initiative was led by Lloyd Bentsen, Secretary of the Treasury in the Clinton administration. His point person for this effort was Frank Newman. Since he was a former CFO of both Wells Fargo and Bank of America, some of you might know Frank. In recognition of my personal 20-year effort to repeal the McFadden Act, I was asked by our industry and the Treasury Department to introduce President Clinton at the signing ceremony allowing full interstate banking on September 29, 1994. This was a huge win for the industry and led to the rapid consolidation and growth of the industry. For example, between 1987 and today, Norwest and then Wells Fargo, after our merger, has made acquisitions of more than 300 banks and over 100 non-bank financial companies. The passage of the interstate banking bill spurred the so-called mega mergers of 1998, Citicorp Travelers, Nations Bank, Bank of America, and Norwest Wells Fargo. There were 15,000 banks in the United States in the 1980s. Today, there are less than half that amount. The top 10 banks in 1980 had $590 billion in assets and 38% market share. Today, the top 10 banks have over $9 trillion in assets and 64% market share. With interstate banking achieved, we now needed the final leg, the repeal of Glass-Steagall that would allow banks to offer its customers any financial product they wish to purchase from us. In the mid-1990s, Jim Leach was the chairman of the House of Banking Committee and the congressman from the Quad Cities of eastern Iowa. Norwest was the largest bank in Iowa, so I got to know Chairman Leach very well. The Federal Reserve started the deregulation effort by allowing banks in the mid-1980s to have 10% of their revenue in capital market areas like investment banking. All of us in the industry worked the halls of Congress for full repeal of Glass-Steagall. I was chairman of the Financial Modernization Committee, which formulated our industry's position on the bill. Later, I became chairman of the Bankers Roundtable and was the point person representing our industry association in trying to convince congressmen to pass the bill. Spurred by the proposed merger of Citicorp and the Travelers Corporation, and after years of work by myself and all of our other industry proponents, including literally hundreds of trips to Washington, the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act was passed in 1999, repealing the Glass-Steagall Act of 1933, allowing financial institutions to be free to offer any and all financial products. Suddenly, the commercial banking industry, the investment banking industry, and the insurance industry all came together to form a much bigger industry called financial services, which is huge and growing fast. $2.7 trillion in size, over five times the size of the traditional banking industry. To put this in perspective, you probably didn't even know that Wells Fargo happens to be the fifth largest insurance agency in the entire world. So, by the year 2000, after 25 long and hard years of work, deregulation had been fully achieved. we could now sell any product our customers wanted in any part of the world, including the United States, at any price that we wished. We achieved all the goals that we established back in 1975. With deregulation and the advancement in technology, the financial services industry exploded in growth. As late as 1970, banks comprised less than 10% of the market value of the S&P 500. By early in 2000, banks routinely were 25% of the S&P, the largest segment of any industry, and reached as high as one-third. In 2006, the financial services industry accounted for 40% of the country's entire business profits, up from a mere 10% in the 80s. Profits from American banks in 2006 were larger than the global retail, pharmaceutical, and automobile sectors combined. And as I mentioned at the beginning of my talk, assets of Wells Fargo grew from roughly $50 billion to $610 billion. Bank America from $119 billion to $1.7 trillion. Because of deregulation and technology, the competitive environment for banking entirely changed. Banks and non-banks are competing for the same savings, investment dollars, and loans. Fidelity, Charles Schwab, Merrill Lynch, State Farm, you name it, they all have banks. Over 50% of General Electric's earnings come from financial services. So-called banks have less than one-third of loans and deposits generated in the economy. Total securitized credits, such as mortgage and asset-backed securities, are twice the size of total bank loans. Corporations now go directly to the commercial paper market for credit. Electronic payments have now surpassed paper checks. Wells Fargo's commercial customers now take electronic images of the checks they receive, send those images directly to our computers, and never enter our banks to deposit or send those paper checks. In 1994, Wells Fargo was the first bank to offer internet banking. Today, nearly 11 million consumers and over 1 million small business customers, two-thirds of all of our checking account customers, use the internet at least once a month. 20% of those receive their statements electronically. Over 75% of our corporate clients use our industry-leading internet portal called the CEO, the Commercial Electronic Office, for their daily banking needs. Over 50% of all foreign exchange transactions, for example, are completed online. So what about the future? Well, more of the same. More competition, more technology. Our customers, for example, are now checking their balances and transferring funds from their mobile phones. Corporate clients can execute wire transfers and review check images from their mobile devices. As a direct result of the current financial crisis, in the next few months and years, we are likely to see the most dramatic change in the financial services industry since the 1980s. Already much has changed. Large traditional investment banks are no more. Only two remain, Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, but they are now bank holding companies, regulated like most commercial banks by the Federal Reserve. In just the past few months, there has been and will continue to be massive consolidation of the industry. Already, Merrill Lynch has merged with Bank of America, Washington Mutual with J.P. Morgan Chase, and, of course, Wachovia soon with Wells Fargo. And this is just the beginning. Many small and mid-sized banks will be assisted into merging with stronger institutions. Governments around the world are pulling out all the stops and are doing whatever it takes to get the credit markets back to operating normally. Let me repeat that. Governments will do whatever it takes to stabilize the financial system. Guarantee all depositors, guarantee bank debt, inject capital directly into banks. All of these tools are being used around the world we speak. Because of these coordinated and unprecedented actions, you can be confident that this financial crisis will indeed end, hopefully by early next year, and begin the long road to stabilization by mid-year. As that happens, the massive fiscal and monetary stimulus will continue, again coordinated throughout the world, as we truly have a global interdependence today, such that economic growth will resume, perhaps at a faster pace than many now forecast. There may be doubts of how long this will take, but let me assure you, it will get done, and done sooner than most people think. Once the economic crisis stabilizes, there will be a complete rethink and likely a significant change in the current regulatory structure. On a more mundane level, regarding the future, the prominent use of debit and credit cards combined with online banking has finally begun to reduce the use of checks, which declined by almost 50% in the last 4 years alone. And they will continue to decline. Cash, however, still constitutes 90% of all retail transactions. This will change dramatically in the future. Prepaid cards will be embedded with cash authorizations and will significantly reduce cash transactions. You will replenish your card online from your PC at an ATM or in the branch. This card may well have other uses embedded, like medical records, for example. Governments will send their welfare and Social Security payments electronically to this card. Security will be improved through biometrics, your eye pupil, or fingerprints. All your checks, 1099s, and bank statements will be electronically transmitted to you and available online for 5 to 7 years. Mary Jo will no longer need shoeboxes full of canceled checks and historical tax records. In fact, that prepaid card may not be a card at all. It could be your cell phone or other mobile device. If the laws change separating banking from commerce, which is not likely in the near term, your phone company, Apple, or Walmart may become your bank, or your bank may become your phone company. Google may become your financial advisor. There are 8,000 banks today. That will fall by at least half over the next 20 years. After all recent mergers already announced are completed, the top four banks in the country will have one-third of all bank deposits. Within the next 5 years, most all large banks will become financial service companies offering almost all financial products, much like Wells Fargo already is doing today. And most all will be national and some international in scope. The banking store will be a financial services store. It will not only house your banker, but also your stockbroker, mortgage consultant, insurance agent, asset manager, trust officer, business banker, replacing all the clerks, paper processors, and extra tellers that existed in those early years. But you won't have to leave your home to connect to all of these people because you will use interactive video on your PC to communicate with them. You will also be able to access such professionals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week through interactive video, just like you do with telephone customer service today. So this brings me to my last point. Given the dramatic changes in banking over the past 30 years, what is now the single most important ingredient for success today and tomorrow in financial services? It's one word, people. We have come full circle. Remember I said at the beginning of my talk that people were not all that important prior to 1975, except if you played golf, because the government dictated what you could sell, where you could sell it, and at what price. There was little innovation and no nationwide competition. Today, in stark contrast, I believe the winners in our industry will be those who have the best and most diverse people. People providing you sound financial advice and superb service. People in our stores, people building our technology, people operating our computers, people staffing our phone banks, and people creating our websites, allowing you to do routine transactions electronically, but giving you the choice to have access to people when you need professional advice. It took almost 50 years, starting during World War II, when women replaced men that went to war, for women to move from entry-level clerical and teller jobs and move through the pipeline with promotions and increased responsibilities to reach the senior executive positions at financial institutions. We cannot take that long for ethnically diverse team members to reach the top. It is our greatest challenge and our greatest opportunity. The faces of bankers must dramatically change to reflect and understand our increasingly diverse customer base. Women and ethnically diverse individuals will be commonplace among the top management of Wells Fargo and many other financial institutions within the next 10 years or less. At Wells Fargo, we firmly believe that our people determine how you, our customers, feel about us. Our people influence the attitude of our customers more than anything else. Isn't that true? Think of yourself. More than any other single factor, your image of Wells Fargo is determined by your interaction with the people of Wells Fargo. I believe our people are more important than our advertising. What good are ads if the experience our customers have with us is not positive? I believe people are more important than our brand, because a brand, even one as famous as Wells Fargo's, is nothing more than an implied promise of great service and sound financial advice delivered through and by people. What good are products and technology or anything else if our service is lousy? Products and technology are reasonably commodities. They can be copied quickly. Technology is only a tool. Sometimes it's just a gadget. It is not a substitute for good judgment. Technology can produce more information, but more information does not necessarily mean better decisions. I can see by the expressions on your face that you agree. But if this is so intuitively obvious, why then don't more companies treat their people as their most important asset? Why do stock prices go up when companies announce that they are laying off thousands of people? Why is it good to lose good people, lose that experience, lose those who have contributed to your past success? So, how do you identify the long-term winners in any industry, but certainly true of financial services, and I'm sure it's true of your businesses as well? Find out who has the best people. But surprisingly, this is not just about aptitude. It's also very importantly about attitude. It's about caring. This is not just about economies of scale. It's most importantly about economies of skill. Do your people enjoy their work? Are they having fun? Are they rewarded and recognized for their dedication to customers? Do they care? At Wells Fargo, our most fundamental belief is in people as our competitive advantage. If our people care more than the people we compete against, care more for our customers, communities, colleagues, and the company, then I can guarantee you we will outsell and outserve our competitors every time. So my job as CEO of Wells Fargo for the past couple of decades was really very simple. Cause the organization to focus on customers. Recognize that the key to consistent bottom-line growth is actually the top-line revenue growth. If your customers are voting with their pocketbooks, you must be doing a lot of things right. Hire, retain, reward, and recognize the best people. Coach them to be effective leaders. Make sure they care. In fact, in selecting people, I don't care how much a person knows until I know how much they care. Give people the responsibility and accountability to run their own businesses. Encourage them to be active in their communities, to in fact be leaders in their communities. Create, describe, and communicate the corporate culture, its vision and values. Make sure everyone is having some fun. Then just get out of the way and cheer as they achieve consistent, record-breaking, industry-leading results. Which, I am pleased to say, is exactly what Wells Fargo has accomplished for the past two decades. The most exciting time in our industry's history. Thank you very much for being here and for your attention, and I would now be happy to answer your questions. Thank you very much. Years and 50 minutes, that's pretty good. Now we can really get into the good stuff.
You were absolutely clairvoyant as far as the topics of the questions, but I'd like to linger for just a moment on the now and then topic. It seems that with each passing financial crisis, the current crisis is the worst, and you've worked through some of the most serious financial crises. I'm thinking of the agriculture crisis, the oil embargo, the S&L crisis. Can you share your perspective as to how the current crisis compares?
Yeah, I think you have to put in perspective what I would call the economics crisis versus the financial crisis. Everyone thinks this is the worst economic and financial crisis we've ever had. And of course, if you're not over 40, you probably wouldn't know any better. But certainly, in my opinion, by far the worst economic crisis of my career, let's say the post-World War II, was the 1980s. I mean, if you think about what was happening there with 20% interest rates, double-digit inflation, double-digit unemployment, basically, if we marked the market, LDC debt back in the 1980s, every major bank would be bankrupt. We're marking the market today, and most major banks, no. But it was a far serious, more serious economic crisis back then. You know, today, you know, we have economic issues. We're probably in a recession. We'll be one until early next year. But we've still got 6.1% unemployment, not 14%. We have, you know, 2 to 3% inflation, not 20%. We have interest rates that are basically at record lows, not at 20%, so far different. It is a more serious financial crisis, however, because the difference is this. is that usually what's happened to banks that and the financial difficulties they get in is that our customers get into problems due to macroeconomic issues that are caused by just normal cycles or by actions that are negatively taken by governments. Our customers get into problems, and then we as the bankers get into trouble. We really caused this crisis. Our customers, other than, say, residential, those involved with residential home building or automobiles, are actually doing still quite good. We're the ones that caused this financial crisis, and therefore it is financially a much more difficult crisis than any other one, but economically it's not the worst crisis. Therefore, if we focus, as the government and regulators are, on fixing the financial part of this before the economy goes into even a more serious situation than we have today, we should be able to get out of this reasonably soon and get growth going again. And that's what they're focused on, and they're going to do whatever it takes, and it will get done.
You are listening to a radio program of the Commonwealth Club of California featuring Richard Kovacevic, chairman of Wells Fargo & Company. I'm Stephen Sewer, program chair for the Now and Then Speaker Series and your moderator for tonight's program. I invite the audience to submit written questions for Dick. To my left, there is a picture of the war bond window at Wells Fargo's Union Trust Office in 1943. People made great sacrifice for the war effort. Why don't we see war bond windows today?
Well, they pay below market interest rates, for one. Well, you know, what's interesting about the war bond, as history will tell you, it was claimed to be to supply funds, you know, for the war and for the troops and so on. But as history will tell you, what it was actually trying to do was to soak up the funds that existed in the economy so it would keep inflation down. It really wasn't. The purpose really wasn't for what they said it was. It was to keep inflation down. And, you know, today inflation is not really a problem. We got other problems, but inflation is not now one of them. So, you know, we really don't need war bonds to suck up inflation at the moment.
During these decades, the federal debt has exploded, and Congress has raised the debt ceiling to above $11 trillion. How high can the nation's debt reach, and what are the consequences for American standard of living?
Well, I think it's a very serious issue. I mean, you can keep issuing debt theoretically until those who are buying it no longer will buy it. But you never want to reach that point, obviously. And I think it's a very serious issue. We're living beyond our means, and it probably will not affect any of us, but it's certainly going to potentially affect our children and our grandchildren. And we have to straighten this out. And you know, there's all kinds of theories on what needs to be done, but we cannot continue to have these very, very large deficits. And this doesn't even include yet some of the issues we have with Social Security and health care going forward, which we have not funded. It's a pay-as-you-go system. And that's only going to add to the issues going forward. So we got some very difficult decisions to make as a country so that we don't burden our future generations with the debt that we created in our times.
Does the baby boom generation represent a golden era in America that won't be repeated?
Well, I hope not. But I think this is probably the first time, in fact, I know it's the first time, that it's unlikely that our children will have a higher standing of living than we did, and that's the first time in America that has happened. And again, a very serious change that we should all understand what caused it and what we have to do to change it, because there was the American dream was always that you would do better than your parents, and the parents sacrificed so that you would do better. And this is the first time that has not happened in amongst all the generations of Americans.
There are a number of questions here on the crises that we're facing today. But regarding the bailout, newspapers report that you were initially opposed to last week's Treasury plan to invest directly in major banks, including Wells Fargo. Is it true that you resisted the $25 billion in capital infusion from the Treasury?
Well, I'll just make a joke. And someone said, you know, I want to meet someone who refused $25 billion. I really can't disclose. You know, you can't be of any help to regulators or government if you don't keep the discussions that you have confidential. I think it was very, very inappropriate for people to be talking about what happened in those discussions. And I can certainly tell you that the discussions that were had were not accurately reported. The only way that you can be effective, the only way that you can be helpful is to talk to people that are making very difficult decisions for the country about directly what the ramifications may or may not be of what they intend to do, and give them your best advice. And then once the decision is made, it's important to support it, because I can certainly say that at least in my particular case, and I think if you ask any regulator or government official, that I've always believed that the system is more important than any individual company. That if the system isn't performing well, no individual bank or company is going to perform well, and vice versa. If the system is working well, then the participants will work well. So you do start with the most important issue, which is what's important and what's valuable to the system. And if that means that a particular individual company has to sacrifice along the way, that's fine. That's what we should do. We're Americans, and we will behave in that way. Having said that, there still can be difference of opinion about what is the best way to support the system. And again, that's what we all try to do, is give advice and suggestions so that the decision makers can make the best decisions. I believe that the decision to support financial institutions with direct capital injections versus buying loans is a far more preferable way to get this get the finance system back at work. To what you're basically doing is offsetting the deleveraging that is going on by all the bad assets that are being written off in the mark-to-markets, and you're replacing that with capital that offsets that deleveraging. And so this is an important step and an important tool to get the financial system back into the lending business again. It'll take some time, but I think it'll be an effective tool, and it will help the system.
How did you really beat out Citicorp for Wachovia?
Well, again, I'm sure there's some people from the press here. I don't mean to demean the press, but the reporting was inaccurate. But again, because these are confidential and you're dealing with regulators and so on, I just don't feel that I should comment on all the various activities that took place. But what is known, and I've said publicly, the issue that we had on the weekend was that we did not have enough time to examine certain of the portfolios from Wachovia, so that on that Sunday night we could not make a decision just because of the lack of time to evaluate the portfolio of doing an unassisted transaction, because we weren't going to put our stockholders and team members at risk of making a bad decision just because we didn't have time to evaluate it. And so we said we could not make that decision. The regulators decided not to wait, and therefore tentatively awarded an assisted transaction to Citibank. We had all the data, and so we just kept working on it. And by Thursday of that week, 4 days later, we had sufficient time to examine the portfolio, and were able to make an offer to Wachovia that did not require any assistance from the government or put the FDIC at risk. And as it turned out, they did not have a signed agreement with Citibank. And so when we made that offer at 6 o'clock on Thursday, Pacific Daylight Time,
By about 2 or 3 hours later, they had signed. I sent them a signed agreement. Said all you have to do is sign, and they did. So we had the only signed merger agreement with Wachovia by, I guess it would be early Friday morning Eastern time, and I think, I don't know, it's probably still Thursday night West Coast. It was about 2 o'clock a.m., I think, from Eastern time. So they had a better deal, didn't require any taxpayer dollars, a signed agreement, and deal done. And so that's kind of what happened. And there's a lot of other things that happened, but I can't. I'd have to kill you, so I can't do that. The issue was very clear. It was we didn't have enough time, and none of this would have occurred if we had had more time, and if it turned out the way it did, that we then became comfortable could give them an unassisted transaction.
There are some questions here that are political. Questioner wants to know who you're supporting in the presidential race.
I don't disclose those things.
Okay. And the next question is, if you were offered the Secretary of the Treasury position, is that something you would entertain?
No. Anyone who knows me well knows that I'd last about 3 milliseconds in the political environment.
How does the current real estate and credit crisis compare with the prolonged real estate crisis in Japan that started in the 1990s?
Well, there are some similarities, but again, I think you have a terrific contrast of how the government and regulators are handling our situation versus Japan. Japan was in a serious deflationary environment. And basically, the government did very little to try to change this spiraling down of deflation. And deflation, as it turns out, is a much more serious problem than inflation because once it starts, it really is very difficult to change the psychology. And the government just didn't do anything for a long period of time. And I think, in contrast, you see that. That our regulators and our government is doing whatever it takes. So we recognize the problem. We recognize the problem before any deflationary issues have occurred, before the economy has tanked. There's a lot of stimulus, both monetary and fiscal, into the pipeline. And that's why I think that it won't take a decade or anything close to that for us to fix our problem. And it took Japan that long because basically they did nothing about it for many, many, many years. And we're doing a lot about it very, very quickly. And I want to repeat, we're going to do whatever it takes to get this straightened out. And I wouldn't want to bet against all the regulators and all the governments of the world. This is a coordinated effort now. That if you want to bet against them, go right ahead, but I wouldn't. They'll get this thing fixed.
What role does culture play in assessing potential merger partners, and did culture make Wachovia more attractive?
Yeah, we have 84 businesses, 170,000 people scattered all over North America, and we believe the only way you can, and yet we believe that you must decentralize the responsibility and accountability to those people. You know, you can't decide what you should be doing in New York or South Dakota or Texas from San Francisco. You've got to put the right people in those places and let them decide who they should make loans to, what community organizations they should invest in, and so on. But you've got to be sure is that they're adhering to the policies and the visions and the values and the culture of your institution. So you manage that through culture, not by command and control, not by hierarchy. And we believe that very much. And the way you do that is through training and communications and making sure everyone understands what the culture of the company and the goals are, but you also do that by the leaders that you have. Most all of the leaders in our company have been with the company 15 or 20 years or more. They're experienced. They understand the culture. They live the culture. They walk the talk. And they instill that in the people that they are managing throughout the organization. So we will not do a merger or an acquisition with any company that we think is culturally incompatible with Wells Fargo, because it won't work. And so it drives the way we run our company. It drives the way we decide whether to merge with somebody. And therefore, Wachovia, we believe, does have a similar enough culture that by bringing these two companies together, we can share, take the best from both and share a common culture, and therefore be a successful merger.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in the program where we have time for just one more question. What keeps Wells Fargo in San Francisco, given the higher cost of living in the Bay Area? Could you ever envision the firm moving to Charlotte or New York?
Where's Mayor Newsom? Why did you submit that question? Well, it certainly increases the difficulty. But, you know, this is our home. It's been here since 1852. I don't ever contemplate that we would move the headquarters, but I would say that if the environment was better for business, there would be more jobs here than there are, even though we're the largest private employer in the Bay Area. And it's unfortunate that we have this great state with all these great resources that we have, but it is not attractive for a lot of businesses. And there's a lot of reasons for that. But when I went to school here, there were probably, 20 major corporations headquartered in San Francisco. We're about the only one left. And there's a reason for that. It's still a great state. People want to live here. It's got a great educational system, higher educational system, and so on, but its business environment is really not competitive with other states, and therefore we lose a lot of business to other states, which is very unfortunate. It will not happen with Wells Fargo, but I would say that if the conditions here were different, we would probably even have more people in California than we do. Even though, again, we're one of the largest employers in California and the largest in the Bay Area.
Thanks to our speaker, Dick Kovacevic, for his participation in the Now and Then series. I would also like to thank our listening audience, both here and on radio, for your attention here this evening. And we invite you to join the discussion by visiting the Now and Then blog at nowthenmlf.blogspot.com. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California celebrating 105 years of enlightened discussion is adjourned.